This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Rex Heerman obviously pled guilty just the other week, but the story doesn't end there. Benjamin Torres was 6 years old when his mother, Valerie Mack, disappeared. You certainly probably, if you've been paying attention to the Gilgo Beach murders, recognize her name. She's one of the victims. Her partial remains were found that same year, dismembered and left in Mandarinville. It took two decades for her to be publicly identified, and it took even longer for the man now convicted of killing her to admit what he did. Torres grew up without his mother, without answers, without anyone being held accountable, not knowing where mom ever went, if she was still around or what happened. Now, as an adult, he has filed a wrongful death lawsuit, not only against Rex Heerman, but against Heerman's ex-wife and his daughter, Asa. The complaint accuses them of knowing about the murders, concealing evidence, and profiting from the crimes through a $1 million documentary deal. The allegations are explosive, but the family's attorney has called the lawsuit reckless and completely unsupported by facts. And law enforcement has never charged either woman with anything. So where does the law actually land on this? And can these claims survive a courtroom? Here to discuss, it's Tuesdays with Bob. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Press subscribe wherever you get that. And YouTube to help us break it down. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Also, of course, with us as well. Bob, let's start here. The lawsuit accuses, not only Rex, but the ex-wife and daughter of knowing about these murders, concealing them, or deliberately ignoring what was happening inside the room. Now, the daughter would have been three around the time of the actual murders. Yes, her hair was found, but it was a hoarder house on some of the burlap. Prosecutors, the people who built the criminal case, have said publicly that the family was out of town when the killings occurred. They've never pressed charges. They've looked deeply into this, and there has been no criminal charges against the family. One would think if that were to come, it would have landed by now. These folks may have truly, truly been completely ignorant of what was going on in their home. And I'm not saying willful ignorance, just ignorant, having no idea what was going on around them. Where do you think this case, where does it take off from, I guess, before we even know where it lands? Does it take off? Does it even get into the air?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's filed, so they're going to have to respond to it. So in terms of how long it's going to survive with what I think is probably very little oxygen is another question. But I mean, there's some real tension here. I mean, so that we have an understanding in terms of the knowledge, it's really what they call constructive knowledge. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not, the plaintiff doesn't have to prove, and let's start with the baseline before I jump in. We're not talking about beyond a reasonable doubt here. We're talking about a civil matter. So we're talking about preponderance of the evidence, much lower burden. Mm-hmm. Basically, you got to cross the 50. And then you're good on that burden. So with the constructive knowledge, they don't have to show that they actually knew. Yeah. But that being said, there's still, our behavioral changes, unexplained absences, evidence around the house. Are they going to have that in order to get to this constructive knowledge requirement that they're going to have to in order to get that claim? Because, I mean, what's really going to happen, T and Robin, is that they're going to file what they call a 12B6 motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. So, like, anytime you get civil lawsuits, it's typically if you can survive either summary judgment and or a 12B6 motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, then you really kind of get into the discovery. So, I mean, initially – and frankly, sometimes, a lot of times, actually, the summary judgment motions don't take place until after the depositions start happening. Uh-huh. I mean, and look, Ray, who's the attorney for the plaintiffs, he can amend this thing. Uh-huh. So this first iteration that we're seeing isn't necessarily the last iteration that we're seeing. So, and it goes in parts of the complaint can survive, other parts can get dismissed. It's not like a broad sweeping thing unless they attack through the 12B6 motion and they attack every single count and claim in there. And the judge agrees that on every single count, you failed to to meet your burden. And then, you know, it's, well, I don't want to jump ahead. There's a lot to talk about. But the bottom line is, it's not an easy case. It's not an easy case for the plaintiff.
What are they going to have to show? What's the plaintiff going to have to show in order to give some feet to this, do you think?
Well,
from what we've seen more in the public, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to have to be a hell of a lot more than just proximity and cohabitation. That's not going to do it. There's going to have to be some concrete facts in terms of what was observable, when, and why a reasonable person would have investigated further. I mean, look, I think the thing that the plaintiff kind of has to their advantage is the fact that when all of us sit here and look at these cases where you've got a wife in a house for decades and they just seem to be oblivious to the fact of what's going on around them with respect to their spouse, like that's how normal people think. So, I mean, but the problem is you've got to make it to a jury before that even becomes a thing. And the problem is you've got to get past that judge and these motions that I'm talking about. The motion for summary judgment is basically saying there is no issue of fact here. These are all issues of law, Your Honor, and they haven't met their burden or they haven't made a claim that's cognizable under the law. So it needs to be summarily dismissed. So, and it's going to be an uphill battle. It really is. And, you know, and I get the concept. I understand the concept of it feels gross that Asa got $1 million.
Sure.
You know, but like, I know we're going to get to that too. But.
And I mean, and the wording is interesting in here. I mean, and this is kind of what I did a monologue on earlier this morning. It's basically stating at some point, in time, knew of, concealed, deliberately ignored, or, and this is interesting, or consciously avoided learning of material facts concerning the assault, murder, dismemberment, concealment, and disposal of Valerie Mack. That wording there, the consciously avoided learning of material facts. People, that's a tough one. It's a very broad net, and I know, like you said, it can be amended and such, but there's, I mean, I'm not saying it's healthy. I'm not saying it's a great idea to have a marriage or a relationship where one has a lair in the basement that no one is allowed to go into except that person. But some people have that sort of an arrangement and they're cool with it. And they suspect, well, maybe he's looking at some, you know, dirty porn or something. They're not necessarily thinking that, you know, it's a murder guide that's going on down there. And I think that's more of a reasonable assumption than to think that the Gilgo Beach killer is in your basement. So to say, you know, I'm choosing to avoid it, maybe just choosing not to see that part of your partner, but you're thinking it's something far less horrible than it is. That's not illegal. That's not against the law. That's not criminal.
And damn hard to prove.
Very hard to prove. I mean, again, wide net. And maybe is this gonna, they're going to have to close the net in a little bit on the allegations to make them, to make it stick in any way, shape, or form. And I'm wondering, you know, at the end of the day, with the fact that there has been no criminal charges against Asa, and obviously we've seen plenty of cases where there's no criminal charges and civilly people are liable. But the fact that, you know, we did get somebody with criminal charges, Rax, at the end of the day, they did not find anything to go after Asa or Victoria on. And they've been looking at this thing under a good microscope with good investigators for the past 3 years and haven't landed there.
Yep.
That doesn't help their case.
Yeah, Bob, is it ever a case where you've seen it where someone actually was liable for not being able to recognize red flags? Because that's what it kind of seems like to me. It's like they're suing her for not seeing the red flags that they think that outside that we were seeing.
I mean, I couldn't possibly know every case that's gone down.
I meant in your experience, your vast experience.
No, I mean, not really. Not like this. This is different. You know what I mean? And it's like I saw the same thing in Gacy with Carol, his second wife, you know, and she went so far as to say that she heard, like, she would occasionally hear screams coming from his garage shed.
And that's a whole thing. That's a wholly different thing than living in a house with a hoarder with a secret room. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, they never went after Carol. And I think with her specifically, willful blindness was a thing.
Right.
Wherein she just had to have known something was amiss. But it was the same thing. She would go up and travel to see her mother who lived out of state. So she'd be gone for long stretches. And obviously, I'm not privy to what was going on between Rex and Asa, but I don't think that there was probably a very healthy sexual relationship with those two based on his predilections. And, you know, I think that there's this aspect of they kind of were like roommates that just lived in that house. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. So in terms of the opportunity for her to be, because I think in the women in chat, I hope will sound in on this. But I think if they're a woman can sense in terms of kind of a lack of any kind of, not even just sex, but just any kind of actual affection. When that kind of like leaves where it once existed, maybe even heavily, like women are on high alert when that starts to happen. You know, at first they might initially be like, oh, is it me? And then they start thinking, no, it's him, you know? And this thing in terms of what was going on for so many years, it's going to be interesting if they can make it to the discovery phase, meaning that they get to depose Asa. Cause I'm of the firm belief that what Johnny Ray wants out of this thing more than anything is to be able to depose her. Mm-hmm. He wants to be able to question her for hours. Right. He wants to dig, you know, to me, I mean, there's a bit of a fishing expedition aspect to it. And again, I mean, he can withdraw the complaint and refile within a year, but one of the things I want to get into at some point is what I think is going to be probably the most interesting aspect of it, which is the statute of limitations potential. Yeah. There.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and let's talk about that because there's an interesting aspect with the statute of limitations because the son of Valerie Mack, who's bringing this lawsuit, these statute of limitations would have expired like almost 20 years ago. But the court has given exception in cases like this where he was been a child, a very small child when this happened, and the fact that they didn't identify Valerie until it was 2020, so not that far ago. Let's speak about that, the statute of limitations. How does that apply in a situation like this? Because there have been exceptions made in the past.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the statute of limitations, where I think it's going to land ultimately, because, again, if you're looking at it in terms of him being three at the time that his mother was killed, your typical statute of limitations, which is, it varies from state to state, but it's typically on a tort like this is 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously that would be long blown. However, where I think that this lays in terms of why it's going to clear the statute of limitations hurdle is the discovery rule, which is how can you expect somebody to file suit when they don't know who the tortfeasor is? So meaning that they didn't know who to sue.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is a civil lawsuit, whether it be Rex that they sued, like OJ got sued after he found not guilty and he lost civilly in that case when Nicole Brown Simpson and Goldman's father sued. They both sued the Brown family and he lost, you know, and that was a huge, even though he didn't go to prison, he had to run from them, you know, trying to take all his money.
And, yeah.
So do you think it was a smart move or not a smart move to include the daughter in this? Because it seems like, you know, Asa, I think it's a little bit easier of a target to go after with knowledge because of, you know, being married in a partnership. But going after the daughter, it seems, is that, do you think hurting them or helping them or just kind of neutral?
Awful. I think that's the weak, like the absolute weakest legal footing that they have in the entire.
Yeah.
A three-year-old cannot form intent. That's required for civil conspiracy. They can't knowingly conceal evidence. There's absolutely no cognizable legal responsibility for acts that are committed when she's pre-verbal.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because again, we jump from different cases all the time, so my memory could be failing us. Wasn't Rex's explanation for his room, isn't that room where he kept all his guns as well? That wasn't his explanation for keeping it locked and away from them, from their knowledge point, yes?
I think that's correct. Yeah, I think that he did have quite an armory down
there. Yeah, and it was in that room, and so that's where I think he built that fiction for them to consume as he groomed them into never ask questions about my room, where I'm also keeping all my diaries and my manual on how to be a serial killer.
Yeah, and I hate that claim against the kids so much that I think its inclusion in the complaint literally invites scrutiny.
Yeah.
Around it.
If it was just to Asa, I'd like, go ahead, dig, see what you can find.
Right, right.
But that Ray lost me a long time ago. Ray lost me last year. Maybe it was you. I don't know. When he did his press conference and he took Victoria's dark paintings and said, see, might have cannibalism in it when he's wearing his hat. And he's been on this show before. He's a very passionate attorney. I don't fault him for that. He doesn't strike me as like ambulance chaser. He strikes me as insanely passionate, almost to a fault. And that's because I feel like he believes wholeheartedly in what he's doing. And so I'm not faulting him. You want an attorney like that. But at the same point, too, it's like he can't see the cliff that he's about to go off because he's so got blinders on and is so motivated and angry. That's what ruins it for me on this whole thing. He lost me on that, and he lost me here too, as far as legitimacy goes, in bringing a legitimate complaint. And there's elements here that probably are. Please do look closer if you want to at Asa. I think that's fair game to examine. I don't think you're going to find anything. But why the hell are we going after Victoria? That just it seems stupid.
And why not the son? Is because he's special needs? I mean, so why one child and not the other?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. See what I mean? It's just, I mean, it doesn't
me
make
going all... after any of the children is just weird.
It's stupid. Yeah.
It's not like I'm curious as to whether or not he tossed this, you know, in front of any other attorney buddies of his to kind of have them say, hey,
you know,
maybe this claim against the kid sucks. Like, and it sucks.
Or is it because she was in the, or was it because I don't think the son was in the special, was it? It was just Victoria and Asa, correct?
I think he made a small appearance, but
so
wasn't.
Maybe it's because of that. Yeah. Maybe because he's just going after the $1 million he made off of that, maybe.
If they never did the special, if Asa never did the documentary with 50 Cent, would there be a lawsuit here, do you think? I mean, I don't think they're considering this either. I have no idea what sort of money may be behind the Huermans. Maybe there's a lot saved somewhere. I don't know. Maybe there's more than this million that they made. But you got to keep in mind, somebody negotiated that deal, so a good chunk of that million went to an attorney, and now she's got attorney fees left and right. You know, there ain't much left at this point, I would imagine, quite honestly.
And, you know, I mean, the other part of it is that she's going to have to pay her attorney to defend the claim.
For this, yes.
Right. So, yeah, it's I don't think so. I don't think if the doc doesn't take place and she doesn't get the payday, I don't think they're suing her because, I mean, the first rule that you learn when you step into your torts class is you don't sue somebody that doesn't have any money because there's no point.
Right.
Judgment against somebody that you can't collect that judgment upon is pointless.
Yeah.
Futile. It's a way you're treading water. You're wasting time and money. And, you know, it's frowned upon. Let me put it that way.
Sure. It'll be fascinating to see where that goes. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Obviously, the other part of the Rex Huerman story is Rex Huerman. He spent nearly 3 years fighting every single charge that was being brought against him and then living more than 20 in incognito, if you will. His defense team lost every motion, DNA, separate trials, the entire framework challenge. Then in a 30-minute hearing, the man who swore he didn't do it pled guilty to 7 murders and admitted to an 8th victim nobody knew was coming. His attorney called it a calculated pivot. But what did Huerman actually gain by making it? And is he accepting responsibility or managing the narrative one final time? Bob Monta, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, is with Robin and myself as we break all this down. Let's talk about that. The calculated pivot. Like every pretrial motion was denied. The DNA challenge, the motion to separate the cases, the all of it. When a defense attorney loses every legal avenue that they have, what does the calculus actually look like behind the closed doors? And how much of this decision do you think was Huerman saying, okay, it's time to come clean, versus his attorney going, we ain't got no roads to go down here, my friend?
I think it was a combination of both.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, whether or not he's going to plea is completely Huerman's decision.
Sure.
All his attorney could do is advise him. But yeah, after you, because you have two things going against you. One, you have the weight of the evidence and the strength of it. And, you know, any competent attorney looking and say, we got problems here. Look, I'm going to try to get, I'm going to file some motions to suppress. I'm going to try to do some different things. The motion to sever was huge. You know, I mean, when they lost that, you know, when you have the cases bootstrapped to one another, you know, it creates an almost unwinnable situation, because that helps boost along the cases that may not have as much powerful evidence as the other ones, because you're trying them all at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, jurors aren't going to be able to compartmentalize those cases in their head as they're hearing all the evidence coming in. They're going to look at them as a group, even though there may have been years in between the homicides. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's that shit that Robin loves. It's the psychology. Oh, it really is. You know, so when you lose that motion to sever, and you know they're trying all the cases together, that's a massive gut blow. But on top of that, when you find out all the DNA is coming in, like it's the one too, right? You DNA is coming in, we're screwed here. And then the other part of it is they're trying all these cases together. A good attorney is going to go to his client and say, we're fucked.
Yeah.
Pardon my French, but we are absolutely screwed here. We are not going to win this thing. So the ball's in your court, Rex. What do you want to do with it? You know, and again, we talked about this last week a bit, but the fact that they don't have that carrot to dangle, that death penalty to pull off the table, it becomes interesting. And I think that we were talking about it, and I was curious to see whether or not this was going to be a plea deal, or what was just going to be a change of plea, which we talked about last week being different things. And ultimately it was kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
It's definitely a change of plea, but you know, Tierney went to him and said, look, you know, here's what we want, you know, and I'll try to make some concessions. I'm not moving on years at all. You're doing all the time. I'll drop a few of the charges or some of the counts, but you're going to be doing the time for each and every victim. And ultimately, you know, I think either way, Huerman was pleading out, no matter whether Tierney was going to offer or not, because there was that big question. I kept all my friends in the industry, cops, like everybody, Huerman's going to go up there and spill it all. I'm like, no, he's going to go up there and just say he's guilty, you know, and it's surprising to me when I see attorneys that practice criminal law, like get kind of sucked into the, you know, just the excitement of it, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
Yeah. And actually, you know, talking about the spilling it all, you know, that's what actually is a little surprising to a lot of people. I think it was actually he's spilling anything. So when he pled, you know, cause we talked about this last week as well, his only currency he has right now to better his life in any way, because this whole move, I still think, is 100% about him not trying to spare his family or wife, because if he wanted to do that, he would have stopped killing people. But it was maintaining his control of knowledge, control of information, things he did. Yet he got up there on this, you know, when he's, you know, changing a plea, and he actually spilled a little information about, you know, how he did these things and through strangulation. Were you surprised by that at all? And what do you think he's going to do with sentencing, more or less or nothing?
Sorry, I was here. My wife had to sneak by to get her shoes out of the I was listening Hi, to every Allie. Word.
Yeah. Hi, Allie. Well,
I mean, the sentencing's pretty much pro forma. The victim impact panels are going to, or statements are going to be huge. You know, they're going to be highly emotional, and those are everything that's going to happen in a, your typical sentencing is going to happen. In terms of any kind of movement on the sentencing, I mean, we know what he's getting. He's getting.
Do you think he's going to spill anything more details? Because he talked about strangulation and how he did it. No, you don't think he's going to be quiet on it?
I didn't think it then, and I don't think it now. It's we talked about this, Robin, and again, this is really in your wheelhouse, man. I mean,
oh yeah, I don't think he's going to say anything. That's why I was asking you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that the dude has, the last vestige of power he has is control. Mm-hmm. That's the information.
Let's talk about Karen Vergata. That's the mother of two from Manhattan who disappeared in 1996. It kind of it puts another murder smack dab in the middle of that time span from 93 to 2000, where people were wondering, like, did he stop doing his things or was he just not caught? It shows that no, he didn't stop. There's at least one other one in the middle there. Gonna guess there's probably more too, but there's another one. Her remains were found in pieces across Fire Island near Gilgo Beach years apart. He was never charged with the murder. It was folded into the plea agreement with no separate prosecution. Explain this one to me, Bob, because we were talking last week, like, how are they going to do this exactly? Explain to me how exactly they did do this.
Well, I mean, essentially what they're going to have to do. So it was obviously part of some discussions that were taking place.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know what Tierney was able to say to Huerman to get him to kind of bite on that and just say, look, man, you know, just give us Vergata. Like, there was some kind of in-depth conversation. I would have loved to have been
able
to hear it. But ultimately, what they did when they folded the Vergata thing into the plea, it really forecloses further prosecution on that act. So essentially, the benefit that Huerman gets is that even though he's – so essentially, they're going to have to formally charge him because you can't mm-hmm. – you can't convict somebody of something they haven't been charged with. So that's going to happen in the interim. Mm-hmm. It's going to get formally charged. And then when it was folded into the plea, so he might not necessarily have to even say it again. But if I'm the judge, I'm probably going to just, once he's formally charged, I'm probably going to ask him again, you know, just so you're pleading guilty to, you know, whatever the case number is going to be on that one. But I mean, look, at the end of the day, if what mattered to Rex, and we were really trying to delve into this last week too, in terms of, you know, why would this guy plea, you know, and if we all landed on, there's no way in hell it was to benefit the victim's families. He's not trying to spare them anything. And we all kind of landed on, seems like it might maybe somewhere in deep, 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 deep inside of his soul, he cares about his wife and his kids, you know, and he didn't want to put them through the nightmare of the trial. I mean, it's really the only thing that I can land on, but it's hard to give him the benefit of doubt to even assume that he has any kind of decency. Just
yeah, I don't think so. Go ahead, Tony, and then I want to go.
Okay. Just a quick thought on that. Here's how I've been thinking about it this week. It's like the end of a movie. It's like the end of Back to the Future 2, where there's like a little tease for the third one. You're like, I wasn't expecting that one coming. It feels to me like that. It's like, okay, you got me. I'm going to go down for these. But did you know about this one? Almost like, hey, there's more to come, kids, because because I think he's in the last couple of years, he's probably kind of gotten used to this new lifestyle of not having to hide it all. It's out in the open. People know who he is. He's kind of digging the attention. And if he can put a little carrot out there for the society that's watching him in the cage, that, hey, you thought I was done? There's far more than you know about. It brings even more attention to him because it's not just resolving these seven. Suddenly there's an eighth. And if there's an eighth, how many more are there?
And that's what I'm thinking, too. You know, especially so here's a man whose health is failing, as they've seen him the last couple of times in his court. So he's fallen apart. And so his chances of getting away with this are zero because of what his lawyer's saying. And so when you think about this, so here's the analogy. Think about a very, very extremely wealthy person. Does throwing down a couple hundred or a couple thousand or even more money really mean anything if you actually have all this money in the bank? Because remember, his currency is information. So he was charged with seven. And he seemed, everyone's shocked that he's actually threw down an eighth and being willing to include it. Well, a wealthy man doesn't matter to them. And so the probability of him having more in that bank, I think, is extremely high, because I think that was a real tell saying there's more there. Because otherwise, remember, his only thing left he has in life is the knowledge that he has and no one else does. Yeah. So why would you give, if that was the last person that's associated, why would you give the last thing you have in the bank just at the change of plea?
Yeah, which is why I said he was never going to do anything like he was thinking he was going to do in terms of spilling.
He's wealthier than we think, is what I think it is.
He's got a mental wallet full of bodies.
He does. So. And it's interesting because, I mean, when you think about kind of the, you know, Gacy went through a trial, but I mean, that dude never fessed up. You know, he never fessed up. And I'm of the same mindset with Huerman that I am with Gacy. And I think that there's additional victims because there's that gap. Mm-hmm. There's gap for Gacy. It was a 4-year gap from when they know that his first known victim was killed. And then from when his next victim is killed, you know, there's this gap in time. And that's when Carol was living in the house. You know, he wouldn't just haywire. He was off the rails as soon as the divorce took place. You know, it was a free for all. But like the other thing that I want to talk about, kind of go back to Tony's point, you know, and I think the other thing that's interesting is the fact that the amount of tension and anxiety and stress, and I don't give a shit how much of a sociopath you are. I mean, the fact of the matter is we know from his hard drive, getting caught was a major concern for him. Mm-hmm. So when once it's over and that stress and tension lifts, it goes right along with what you're saying, you know, because that's a long time to live on the run, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a stressful way to live.
Yeah.
You
know?
So, yeah.
I want to get your thoughts on this. Me and Robin and Coffendaffer were talking about this the other day, about how much of a carrot was it that the BAU, the Behavioral Analysis Unit, was actually worded into the plea agreement here that he's going to cooperate with them and he'll be studied. Now, obviously, the BAU is going to go in no matter what. It's not like you really have a huge choice in this matter for somebody like this. But I'm wondering, how much do you think it was a carrot on a stick for him to go, oh, well, I'm that important that you want to come talk to me? I'm wondering if it kind of worked in a weird way here, not as a threat, not as a, we're going to dive into you and figure you out, but more like, I'm a celebrity and I'm getting celebrity treatment now in his own weird ecosystem.
Yeah, I take it a different way. I think that was tossed in there more as a carrot to the families because, you know, I mean, we don't know. And I was thankful that what's her face stood up there. I always forget her name. The attorney who handled some of the was representing the victims' families. Somebody,
yeah,
the attorney, the old time Gloria Aldred. Yeah. So when she steps up and she basically has or speaks on behalf of the family members that they're fine with this, that they're good with it, they're in support of this thing getting pled out as opposed to going to trial, because that's one of the things you always wonder. You know, do the families want that person to sit in that chair and squirm? And do they want to hear all the details or do they not? So for me, I was thankful that she came up and said those things because it really kind of gave me some insight into it. And I think that from Tierney's perspective, I think that would help soften the blow if you had family members that were very much wanting him to stand trial. Like, look, I know, but we talked this guy into helping, like we're, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a pretty nice pitch to put out there.
Yeah.
I like that, Bob. I like that a lot. I think that carries a lot of weight. I wonder if part of that with the discussion with the families, whether they told them that we will share what we find with you if you want to know it too.
Yeah.
Because those are things. And I mean, when you think about this, it makes it so that they can hear and get some closure without it being on a public forum necessarily as well. It'll be researchable and it'll be open source and things like that that they can get access to, because this is what BAU does. They provide research for organizations and other great crime fighters out there. But I hadn't thought about that angle of it. It's a really, I think it's a really poignant one. I think it's, I'm glad they're doing it for that reason, no doubt.
Yeah, I think of it from that angle,
I'm guessing. But I mean, to me, that would be why they would include it, whether it's true or not. And I hope that it is true. You know,
maybe it's a little bit of everything.
And if not, you can make it true now. You know, if people are paying attention to this, I think the families then need to say, hey, that's a frigging great idea. I want to know or I don't want to know. I mean, it gives them the choice without having it broadcast and have to listen to it. That's what I really like. It's victim focused, and here's an opportunity that you can learn more, but you don't have to learn more. Whatever you need for closure, and you won't have closure on this in the life, no one ever does, but be able to continue to move forward in your life and move on, move through, I should say.
100%, man.
Now they just need to bring back another season of Mindhunter, because...
It's dead in the water, man. It's like, I keep hearing like, and then they just fall away. It's weird. It was such a great show.
I know. It's got, it's Emmy nominated. It's like people, it's like, bring it back. Bring it anyway. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts on that. And press subscribe to Bob's podcast, Defense Diaries, wherever get podcasts.
And Buried.
And Buried.
Casey investigation. It's my life's work. It's like,
yes,
I really want people to listen to it. It's a phenomenal podcast. It's unlike anything you've ever heard.
So. It is. It's very good.
Love it.
Buried.
I'm testing it again. I'm moving back on it. I refuse until the whole world's listened to it. So
and that's all you want, the whole world. And then get them all to buy my book.
Exactly. Yes, in Robin's book here.
Like, you know, if you listen to the full podcast, we'll give you Robin's book.
Welcome to QVC. That's right. Today we have a delicious book here from Robin. It's not all about me. This is bursting with country fresh flavor.
It's about unlike Bob.
Anything you've ever had. Also available for books here. So let's go to another case here that we are discussing. For months, everything about the criminal case and Anna Kempner's death was sealed. Juvenile proceedings, closed courtrooms, no public charges. The family was left waiting. That just changed. A federal grand jury has indicted the stepbrother as an adult on charges of first-degree murder and aggravated abuse. And what this indictment alleges is very different from what the public was told in the early days of the investigation. Joining us to discuss, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, available wherever you get podcasts, and Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's start here. This is a case we talked about quite a bit last year. Then it kind of just went silent because he's juvenile, and then everything sealed. So there really was no information. And we were going to kind of operate of, we're not going to know much more about this if it stays in juvenile court. It's not staying in juvenile court. It's now going to adult court. He's being charged as an adult. And we've now learned that it wasn't just asphyxiation. There was SA alleged that took place in that room on that Carnival Horizon ship between the 16-year-old stepbrother and Anna Kempner. Let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, this changes the whole dynamic of everything that's going on here. You got cameras showing one person going in and out of that room. You got the other brother that's saying he heard noises. We only got one person in there. I mean, unless this guy's Batman or somebody's flying in and out of portholes, it's pretty dead to rights. Where does this case even take off from, or does it? Is it do you see this end up being a plea deal, or do you think something like this? Do you think they're going to fight it? Do you think they're going to try and plead not guilty on something like this?
No, I think he's going to plead out.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah. He's not Diddy. You just don't go to trial in federal cases. You don't play with the U.S. attorney's office. When they come with their case, their shit is on lock. I mean, their conviction rate is 98, you know. So I think that he'll plead out.
How do you think they got it up to charging him as adult at 16?
I mean, I think that they put it out there where there was enough there for everybody to feel comfortable that it would, because the judge looked at it, right, and it's not a rubber stamp, but you know, the judge at some point had to agree that it was serious enough to take a teenager out of that juvenile system And, you know, it's ultimately the judge makes the call. And that, and, you know, and he made a finding, or she made a finding. They examined the, you know, the nature of the offense, the circumstances, and whatever the sealed juvenile proceedings revealed about his background, his mental state, mm-hmm. and prior conduct. Like, they're going to look at all of it, you know, because it's like I they're going to be more thorough in the federal system than they will be in the state typically.
Right. And is that what took so long to do this? Because that's the other question I had, too, is like what took so long to get it moved up? All right.
I think so. Oh, and also just putting the case together to put in front of the grand jury.
Go ahead, Robin.
No, I had nothing, Tony. Go ahead.
When you have a case like this, is there like a lever that gets pulled at a certain point? And we've talked about this before, about the importance of not always charging every, you know, teenager that's, you know, of a certain age, 13, 14, 15, 16 and above as an adult, because you are still a youth. But there are certainly times where it is certainly appropriate. Is there ever a lever that is just there where it's like, okay, you killed somebody and you essayed them? That's pretty adult behavior. You know, it's murderous, monstrous behavior, but it's not typically the behavior that a child is necessarily capable of. When you get the essay mixed in there with the murder itself, I mean, is that where it's like, yeah, you're going to be charged as an adult now because you're capable of doing that?
100%. No. You know, because the judge ultimately concluded that this simply, because of all the things you just talked about, was not a case where juvenile intervention was going to adequately address what had happened.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a whole different system, the juvenile system. You know, I mean, under the juvenile system, in theory, he can walk out when he hits 18 or 20, 21. You know, I mean, it's a whole different thing. So, and that's a meaningful signal for a couple of reasons. First, it means that the judge really reviewed the underlying record, you know, and found that the offenses were serious enough in the defendant's profile sufficiently warranted that he be tried as an adult. You know, I mean, that's big. And I more than most probably appreciate that. Like, my wife and I are always of the mindset. We hate when children are tried as adults, no matter how horrific the crime is, because we're just not talking about a fully formed mind.
You know,
that cortex is not fully formed. I don't give a shit what anybody says. That's science. You know, that's just a reality. And it's like
24. Yep.
Exactly. And we have that pull, that internal pull. But the acts were so horrible. We have to hold this person accountable for it. So all to say that if they're going to charge juveniles as adults, which they will, and they will continue to do so into the future, I appreciate when they put this much work into it. And I'm telling you, they put this much work into it. Because in terms of it getting bumped up to the, you know, to adult court is really a two-part thing. And it goes back to what we were talking about initially. And Robin knows better than anybody. When the feds are building a case, you know, they're incredibly deliberate in what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they are making a case that is, for all intents and purposes, bulletproof. You know, I mean, that's why everybody pleads in federal court, because when the AUSA steps to you and are like, this is what we got, bro, you know, and then they put the heat on you right away. So it's like you almost start working on your sentencing, your sentencing like immediately, because the sentencing guidelines in terms of federal court are vastly different than that in which you find in state court. And those sentencing memos are really become a trial in and of themselves, because they're that thorough, because you've got so many factors and there's points that are assigned or deducted based on various things. And a lot of that has to do, because the feds have the ability to put the squeeze on defendants and their attorneys by saying, look, you know, you're going to have a pretty hefty deduction if your client's not going to work with us, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, we need him to work with us, and we also need him to take responsibility. You know, it's like those are words that are actually, and you get credit for that. So in terms of whatever you're going to end up on with this plea, and I'm not going to bet my life on it, but I'd go 95% secure this thing's going to plead out.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that actually, and a lot of people are commenting in the comment section on this too. So, and we've seen this in other recent cases with school shootings. What do you think the liability on the parents are going to be on this? You think they're going to go after them next?
Nah, different set of circumstances. And unless we can, unless it comes out that there was some kind of long running issue in that house that they're aware of and they were simply ignoring it, and they ignore it to the extent where they put this kid in a room with her on a boat, knowing
but that's what it looks like. Again, that's just what some of the hearsay was saying. Like the ex-boyfriend of the girl was saying that the creepy things that the brother was doing. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they're going to have continue to dig deep on that and do anything with that, just because. I mean, because
of those school shootings, they have the ability to do so now. And when I say the ability, they've always had it. But once prosecutors started creating that precedent and sacking up, because it's a big risk in terms of being a prosecutor, because it's a tough case. And, you know, prosecutors will tell you, every one of them, I'm not trying to bring a case that I'm destined to lose. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We want to have the evidence. And in those cases, it's iffy, because you have your evidence problems, but you also have public perception.
You know, and wouldn't it be interesting, not interesting, tragically so, you know, I know we're covering so much of the IBLP and the FL, you know, the fundamental
FLDS, yeah.
FLDS, you know, stuff where parents are overseeing children of theirs that are doing abhorrent things against their own children and others, and, you know, potential liability there. So we're seeing some potential cross here, you know, at that federal level, where, you know, you have cults that are actually grooming people to do this. And then you have this situation over here. I wonder, again, it's just because we're covering these things that my mind starts working and seeing if there's any connection between the two that they might bring
up. It's always going back to the cults, man. He's
cult to me, man. I'm cult whispers right now.
It's a fascinating thing. I mean, there's elements, you know, almost you could go back to the Asa story too, of, okay, you know, what were you aware of? And I mean, if you're looking at the parents, and, you know, hindsight's 20/20 on something like this, horribly so, unfortunately. And the toll was losing your daughter. I mean, one could look back and go, yeah, there were warning signs. You know, at the end of the day, most parents are not going to go to the extreme of your daughter's going to be essayed and murdered by your stepson. Yeah. You know, they go, well, it might be kind of uncomfortable. And they're not thinking how extreme this could go, because people don't tend to go there usually. And they're thinking, well, you know, they can tough it out. They're kids. They're just going to sleep there. They're going to be out on the cruise ship all day. And this is probably how they were thinking, right or wrong. This is probably as simple as it was going. And they offered her, and I'm not saying that this was the right crawl either, but they said, this has been their argument the whole time, well, we offered her, she could go stay with her grandparents, she could go stay in this room over here. Yes, then she would also have to raise her hand and inconvenience other people too, in her mind, and stay in a place that she really wasn't originally planned to be. This is where it just, the parenting needs to stand up in situations like this. And I get, you know, you try to save a buck, you're going to try and do this as economically as you can so you can go on this trip. Excuse me. But if you got an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old young woman, and you're thinking of putting her in a room with 16-year-old boys that already have a history of not appropriate interaction or attempted interaction with her, you got to get another room, or don't go on the damn cruise. Don't put it on her to make that choice of, all go sleep with grandma and grandpa, because mom and dad couldn't make a responsible choice here. And I'm not blaming them. I'm not saying it was criminal. You look at it, like I said, and go back and go, gosh, we should have done that differently. And maybe this is a lesson to be learned for other folks going on cruises who are in a blended family situation where there's some weird dynamics with some of the kids, or uncomfortable. Sometimes you got to do these sort of things to prevent something far worse from happening. She's dead. That's how we're hearing about her. I have a striking fear that there are far more cases like this where it ain't death that's in question. It's an essay that never gets reported and never talked about again. And I think that happens quite frequently. And for this exact same reason of, well, let's save a buck and kids will be kids. And in reality, these are young adults. These are young little monsters that make poor decisions.
Yes, without question. And who's whose son is it? Is it the dad's or the mom?
It's the new wife's son. So they recently got married. It's the stepson, so it's a step sibling to Anna.
Yeah. So in that type of situation, and I want to kind of go back to Robin's question because it really kind of got me thinking. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it, but you know, those cases where they are trying to and are bringing charges against the parents, it always boils down to knowledge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Knew or should have known. And it would be interesting to see. I mean, yes, we have the boyfriend story, but did that story make it from daughter to dad? You know, is she like this kid's like a super creep? You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, what's the context? Yeah.
But like, even it has to have made it back to the parents. They have to have knowledge of it taking place.
Say there's, Bob, so is this enough? So say there's text messages. Say there's maybe not even to the parents, but say the daughter who was horrifically murdered and assaulted was sending text messages. Because I think it's been a while. I think there was her expressing concerns. I mean, girls express concerns of friends about seeing situations. If they pull up text messages of her vocalizing, at least even through texting to friends or maybe even family members, her concerns and issues, is that enough to make it an issue for the parents?
I don't think so. Unless the parents are made aware of it, you know, but if she's made an outcry, so to speak, to any kind of mandatory reporter, creates an issue for that mandatory reporter if they didn't report it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's right. Yeah.
That's a different issue. It'll be interesting to see, man. And how long were they married?
Not long. I mean, there was still a custody. I don't have the exact date, but I believe it was like less than a year. It was recent. Yeah. It was like a celebration like type cruise of, you know. One more question on this.
The stepdad's off the hook because the stepdad's not going to know. You know, the stepdad had this kid for 16 years. He barely knows the kid from a hole in the ground at that point. You know, and the mom, that's potentially a different story. You know, I'm sure the feds are digging into what the mom knew.
Yeah.
That was all part of the stuff that they were looking at.
Yeah.
Deciding whether or not to try him as an adult.
True. You know what I mean? True.
Into that stuff.
That's all been examined, I'm sure. Yeah. And if appropriate charges would be appropriate, then I would think that they'd be made or are coming very quickly, if at all. One more question on this. I mean, I know you think it's going to get pled out, and it probably will be. Does he have a leg to stand on in anywhere with he was on the ADHD meds? And again, for anybody who's like, I'm on HD, but yeah, so am I. And I know it doesn't make you a killer. I'm not saying it does. I'm saying how people litigate things. The ADHD meds, didn't take his insomnia medication. I don't know what that medication was. Some of those can have, you know, anytime you stop taking a med of any sort, that can cause some not great behavior sometimes. And that alcohol might have been involved, and he's a minor. We don't know that alcohol was involved as a fact. Does that give him a leg to stand on in terms of any sort of defense of not being responsible for these choices?
I mean, it could potentially, they could put forth a diminished capacity type defense, but it's here to tell you in federal court, the scope of that is extremely limited.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as broad as it is in state court. So, I mean, they can introduce, you know, the evidence of a mental disease if he has one. They can also show, because I think I had seen something like he hadn't taken his ADHD meds for a couple of days, you know, introduce the alcohol, but at the end of the day, it's never going to walk him out in terms of a not guilty, you know, it's not going to get there. So ultimately I just think that that's a non-starter.
I saw the comment there, and it'll end up in one of the disclaimers where may cause you to essay and murder your stepsister. That'll be read very quickly at the end of a commercial. You know, may cause drowsiness, may cause you to murder your stepsister. Just bear, like, did I just hear that right?
Yeah.
Did it just say it may cause you to murder your stepsister? That's a new one.
I mean, when they throw suicidal ideation in there, and Robin will tell you, I mean, it's looked at is the same as homicidal ideation.
You never hear that in the ads, though. You never hear homicide may cause you to murder.
Actually, you do.
You do?
not murder, but I hear suicidal ideation. That's
and taking a life is taking a life. It doesn't necessarily discriminate about, because remember, a lot of suicides are homicides.
Right.
Exactly. Nobody wants to take the med that may cause homicidal ideation. Like, people are good with the first one, but the second one, it's like, that's a bridge too far.
Tony, I really want to get rid of that foot fungus, man. So, you know, it's
like, may take out the family, but the fungus
comes
is gone.
At a massive cost. You know, you might wipe out your entire family, but by God, your foot fungus will be gone.
Thank goodness.
Now that incessant scratching and itching's gone, that's all that really matters.
Ask your doctor if fungicide is right for you. All right. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Check out Bob's Cop Podcast, Defense Diaries, wherever you get podcasts. And Buried, it is also available wherever you get podcasts. It's a deep dive into the John Wayne Gacy story, like only Bob can tell it, because only Bob has the tapes. So it's quite a podcast. Do check both of those out. Robin's book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever books are sold. Go check this out. It's delicious, and it is bursting with country fresh flavor. I just want to say that again.
Next one is going to be It's All About Bob.
It's part of this complete breakfast, by the way. All right. Until next time, for Bob, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.